We have seen how fifth column work destroyed the will to resist in France by sowing internal dissension and paralyzing initiative. The Anglo-Saxon temperament is certainly not as suitable material as the Latin temperament for such activities, but we cannot count on complete immunity, and if the self-poisoning seeds really struck root, they would be proportionately harder to eradicate from the tougher material. We had given warning before on this point. We give warning again. Although the group soul, like the bloodstream, tends to destroy all alien influences that impinge upon it, there is a degree of massive infection which overcomes resistance. Moreover, if the attackers have the sense to concentrate on existing weaknesses and defects in national character and intensify them, instead of trying to turn us into a new and unnatural channel, a very great deal of disruption can be brought about. Our principal protection against this form of attack lies in the fact that our enemies are aliens and do not understand our psychology, judging others by themselves, as everyone tends to do. Their attempt to undermine our morale by broadcast propaganda is looked upon as light entertainment, and the BBC has not found it worthwhile to try to jam it, its ineptitude being its best antidote. But if disgruntled members of our own group soul took up the task, it would be a different story. They would operate from inside our psychic defenses, they would strike along the true lines of cleavage in our group soul. What could be our defense against them? Before answering this question, let us first ask another. Is there any reason to believe such activities are going on amongst us, or are we merely considering a possible contingency? We answer that there is good psychic reason to believe that such nuclei, or cells, as they are called, exist, but are at present on a small scale. The authorities, who are by no means oblivious to this kind of menace, made short work of the overt organizations in the early days of the war, and so paralyzed their compromise and cooperation activities. But now, the war being already won on the inner planes, a new move is afoot to cause us to lose the peace. Where and how it is being developed we do not know. Our readers may be assured that the information would be in the hands of the authorities if we did, but that something of an organized and directed nature is afoot we are certain. It is of a mental nature, and it can be countered mentally. We are often asked how to counter mental attacks. We answer that the method is simple as the method of ridding a room of darkness by turning on the light. The erecting of psychic barriers is of no use against the enemy within the gates, who is turning against us our own weaknesses and exploiting legitimate grievances. How then can we prevent our morale from being undermined, our will from being deflected from its purpose, our inertia encouraged, our selfishness stimulated? No negative methods can avail against the stimulation of septic foci within the body politic, nor can we cut them out in many cases without eradicating vital structures. Just as in the body the best defense is its own regenerative power, so in the group soul the best defense against this subtle poisoning is the stimulation of its most dynamic ideals. To do this we must proceed according to the laws that govern the workings of the group mind, for it is the group mind that is being attacked. We must formulate clear-cut and brightly colored mental pictures to embody our ideals, such pictures as are to be found in books for children, for he group mind is essentially a child mind, being the aggregate of the average, and humanity en masse is very undeveloped. These pictures must be dynamic, representing vigorous action, and they must relate to crowd action, not in a personal experience. They must represent an army with banners mobilized in the service of God. For such a purpose the conventional religious images are unsuitable, they are too personal and passive, but in the Arthurian legends we have what we need. We have psychological material admirably adapted to our end, and a noble spiritual motif. Let us call up Arthur and his knights to lead the idealism of the nation, with the wise Merlin in the background to deal subtly with subtlety. The 5th of July 1942 in the Crimea, Sevastopol finally falls to the Germans after 25 days of vicious hand-to-hand fighting. Dion Fortune used her 123rd letter to look back once again upon the past work of the meditation group. One feels with a sense of achievement in a job that was approaching its conclusion. Letter number 123, for July 5, 1942. When the war opened, the national morale had for the past year been at a lower ebb than it has ever been during my lifetime, which is not a short one. Never, even during the days when Zeppelins had us completely at their mercy, do I remember anything remotely resembling the panic caused by the war scare of September 1938. When war really came, however, a deeper stratum of the national consciousness began to assert itself, and morale steadied. With the memory of those years behind me, I knew pretty well what to expect, and planned our progress of work accordingly, stopping our magazine to conserve paper supplies for the inner group work, cutting down lectures and classes in expectation of transport restriction and call up of personnel, and generally taking in sail. When the pressure came on, it found us with a well-barricaded basement into which we retired, and a program which we have been able to carry out. Obeying instructions from the inner planes, we disappeared underground before the storm, in obedience to similar intimations we may be said, metaphorically speaking, to be cautiously coming up the area steps at the present moment. Let us hope it is a good omen, and that we are like the birds that are the farmer's weather guide. Our first war term saw us with all activities stopped except a meditation circle organized for work on national morale. Week by week these letters went out, giving instructions for the lines that work was to take. Those who have files of past letters will observe how the phases through which our work passed kept some 6 months ahead of the phases through which the national consciousness passed. Equinox by equinox, that which had formulated on the inner planes during the preceding epoch came into manifestation on the physical plane. We worked on mass morale, we worked on the need for leaders, and on psychic attacks on our national morale. As time went on, and it became clear that the tide had turned on the inner planes, we concentrated our attention on the problems of reconstruction, indicating the lines it would move along and the pitfalls to be avoided. Gradually, week by week, the ground has been covered, till these papers form a pretty comprehensive blueprint of the world after the war, insofar as the internal affairs of this country are concerned. We were told from the commencement that the realizations thus obtained would impregnate the subconscious mind of the race, and be given forth from the rostrum of national life. We went forward in faith, but even so, it was with something of a shock that we realized that the task had been taken out of our humble hands by the Times, whose leading articles and correspondence columns, the recognized mirror of the national mind, gave our teachings an expression that was not only adequate but often verbatim, so that we find ourselves divided between a sense of the nearness and reality of great cosmic forces and an appreciation of the humor of the situation, and the mouse, having given birth to a mountain, cannot resist the temptation to admire the view, except that it does not give meditation subjects. The Thunderer is carrying on the esoteric tradition worthily, and we see no occasion to compete with it. We now propose to turn our attention to international reorganization, and it will be interesting to observe whether the same sequence of events will ensue. Shall we once again formulate the abstract principles and see them in 6 months' time given concrete expression by those who have the ear of the nation? This has already happened in several instances, including the one on which we received the most adverse criticism of all, the abolition of the color bar, which has been definitely laid down as one of the bases of the reorganization of our colonial empire by the colonial secretary. We must see it as individuals and as a group that this notable advance in Christian principle and biological practice does not get sidetracked by the dead weight of prejudice, and the more dynamic activities of the tendency to overcompensate our personal inferiorities by taking advantage of anyone whom circumstances have placed at a disadvantage. We suggest that people who hold strong views on this point should consider how they would feel if the Germans won the war and established themselves over here as the Herrvolk, and they were to experience the working of racial discrimination from the wrong side of the barrier. Let us remember, in these times of radical readjustment, that it is our duty to follow truth wherever she may lead, and to place no barriers in her path, cost what it may. In the October of 1942, just 3 years after the commencement of the weekly letters, the series came to an end. Friends and members of the fraternity now received a monthly letter, which it announced itself in the following terms, with a glance to the past and to the future. Monthly letter number 1, for October 1942. Editorial. 2. The friends and members of the Fraternity of the Inner Light. We are wondering whether you will be glad or sorry that the weekly letter is now to be issued monthly, and in expanded form, though still only the pale ghost of the original Inner Light. Our motives are partly to economize labor, and partly for a reason which we hope you will approve in order that a more varied diet may be offered to our readers. The weekly news sheet served a purpose during the critical early days of the war when morale wavered in the balance. It also had a steadying influence during the days of the Blitz. Moreover, in those days, may they be gone forever, it was a great advantage only to have to survive for 1 week, instead of four, between successive issues. Our readers stood a much better chance of getting the next number. The present monthly letter contains the same amount of material as the weekly letters issued for the same period. It will contain a short editorial giving news of the activities of the fraternity and any other matters of interest arising therefrom, an article on the lines of the familiar weekly letters, two other articles, one dealing with the practical applications of occultism, and the other with its deeper issues. We thus help to provide more varied fare of more lasting value and, as labor and paper supplies permit, to increase our boundaries till once more we reach magazine proportions and the Inner Light reincarnates. October 1942-195,000 Allied troops begin the El Alam offensive. The first of the longer articles now featured was a general outline of the occult teachings presented by the Fraternity of the Inner Light. Monthly letter number 1, for October 1942. The occult teachings. There are many different reasons why people study the occult teachings. Some like them because they are spectacular. Some love a mystery for its own sake. Some seek to penetrate the secrets of life and the unseen. The best reason, and the most widespread, is a desire to understand life and the universe better in order that one may cope with it better, and it is to the people who read these lines for that reason that I would wish to speak. The sensationalist, the mystery monger, and the intellectually inquisitive have no interest for me, and I have nothing that would interest them to offer. To the seeker after knowledge for the solution of life's problems, I would say, come, let us reason together. Concerning the occult tradition, its teachings and their practical application, I can offer them the experience of a life spent on the path. Nor will I ever mislead them by asserting anything to be a fact that I do not know to be such on good evidence, and I will always produce my evidence. Between tradition, history and experience, careful distinction must be made. Also between objective and subjective experience gained through the five senses and subjective experience gained through the higher states of consciousness. Nevertheless, if we limited ourselves to the consideration of documented history and verifiable objective experience, we should miss much, for there is a wealth of information to be derived from tradition if we know how to interpret it and from subjective experience if we know how to countercheck it. The mistake is made when the different classes of data are confused and it is not clear from which source a particular statement is derived. This is unfair to the student, for it confuses his judgment. Moreover, the different classes of data have different evidential value, the objective and historical ranking first, and the traditional and subjective following after, to lead a student to believe that is historical which is traditional, or that is objective which is subjective, is to take an unfair advantage of him, and indicates, if I may be pardoned for saying so, either ignorance or dishonesty on the part of the teacher who is guilty of it. Nevertheless, much data which ranks as traditional could be transferred to the ranks of the historical if the necessary scholarship were forthcoming, and much which is subjective could be given the same authority as objective observations if an adequate psychological technique were applied. To do these things has long been one of our aims in the School of the Inner Light. In the mass of literature and symbolism which we call the occult tradition, we can discern a general pattern or plan. It falls into two broad divisions: teachings concerning the little understood powers of the human mind, and teachings concerning the mind side of nature obtained by means of these little understood powers. The reader, when he first embarks upon such studios, will want to collect a certain amount of data for consideration. It is not possible for him to follow a train of philosophical thought concerning something of which he has no experience and has heard but the vaguest rumors. I will therefore try to supply some data drawn from my own experience. An interest in occultism usually starts in the realm of subjective experience. People feel vaguely that there must be some kind of hidden reality stretching out beyond what the senses reveal to them. Moreover, the tradition of a mysterious wisdom leading on to power is so widespread that there can be few who have never heard of it, even it be only in the form of sensational fiction. Sometimes there comes a sense of the actual presence of an invisible reality, sometimes there comes an intellectual realization of its possible presence, whichever it is that is the starting point of the quest. The awareness of the existence of an invisible reality, and the gathering of knowledge and experience concerning it begins as gradually as the dawn of consciousness in a newborn child. Indeed, an initiate is often referred to as twice born in contradistinction to the once born, who are aware of their physical existence only, the second birth being into the realms of the higher consciousness, where the seeker has to begin at the beginning, even as the newborn babe, and amassed data through experience and interpreted in the light of a growing understanding. If people would be content to begin at the beginning with the small things of personal psychic experience, they would progress much faster than they do if they wait for something drastic in the way of manifestation to happen to them. We all have had experience of intuitions, of minor instances of telepathy, or of an awareness of the subtle atmosphere of persons, places or things brought about by mind power. Let us make a start from our own personal experiences and build on those, for it is out of these that the higher ranges of the occult powers are developed. All the elaborate technique of operative occultism is but designed to develop and utilize and coordinate those small seeds of unseen powers. First the seed, then the ear, then the full corn in the ear. However well the field be tilled, if there is no seed therein, it is barren ground. Then, you will ask, who sows the seed? Is there spontaneous generation on the psychic plane? No, there is nothing of the sort, any more than there is spontaneous generation of something out of nothing on the physical plane. The psychic faculties are normal in a primitive stage of development of humanity. They become overlaid by the physical senses and the rational mind as evolution progresses, and they become correlated therewith after a certain amount of progress has been made. It is the correlation of those lost subtle senses of primitive man with the rational consciousness of civilized man which constitutes true psychic development, as distinguished from the retrogressive psychism which arises in certain pathological mental conditions due to dissociation of the personality. Such a concept, however, turns upon a belief in reincarnation. This is the real keystone of occult studies. If reincarnation is not a fact, then is all our hope of initiation in vain, for no one can make such progress in a single life as would enable him to pass through all the stages of evolution and achieve its goal. Life after life, the initiate believes, he comes back to Earth, not only with another body but with another personality. His spiritual self alone being the unifying factor, life by life he recapitulates his previous development of consciousness, just as he has already recapitulated the life of the race in his prenatal existence, passing from the unicellular to the multicellular, from fish to frog to mammal, finally to be born in the human form. But if he has once acquired extended consciousness, he will retain an awareness of its possibility even if the powers themselves have to be reawakened by laborious training and exercise. Those who have an inner certainty of the existence of invisible realities, and an inner urge to pursue this study and seek its experience, have certainly been on the path in other lives, and it is subconscious memories that they are drawing upon and are driven by. In such persons there is a nostalgia for the unseen which will not let them rest, a divine discontent with materialism, whether as a philosophy or as a science. The seed is in their souls when they are born, and only awaits its due season to germinate. Those who undertake the preparation of students for initiation soon learn to distinguish between the once born and the twice born, the barren field and the sown, and on the gradings thus made we base the training we give to our students. There is an irreducible minimum which all must have in order that they may acquire a working knowledge of the system we use, for mystery systems vary as between the different traditions, and even the different schools of a tradition, and training in one does not admit a student ready-made to the higher grades of another. Once the irreducible minimum has been acquired, however, progress is by attainment and not by seniority. The first monthly letter also revealed a hitherto well-kept secret, the mediumship of Diane Fortune. By way of example, there followed a long communication received by such means. This is the voice of one of the masters, or elder brethren, or in a plain adepti, to which in the past Diane Fortune had often referred. The difference in tone between this mediumistically received communication and Diane Fortune's own style of writing is noticeable. In content and intent, this example appears to be a general address intended for those who aspire to initiatory training within the fraternity. The pattern of individual growth is illustrated by reference to Masonic symbolism, of the rough stone from the quarry being shaped and polished before being hoisted to its rightful place in the temple structure. Monthly Letter Number 1, for October 1942. The Mediumship of Diane Fortune. The mediumship of Dion Fortune has been a well-kept secret within the inner group of the fraternity, but it has recently been decided to make a secret of it no longer in order that certain of the teachings thus received may be made available for all who follow the path. The following address was received through her mediumship, and is here given verbatim. It is hoped that similar addresses, and extracts from others, will be available for each issue of the monthly letter. There is a great wealth of unpublished material thus received which will be released for publication. Greetings, my children, tonight I want to talk to you about an aspect of the mystery work which is very practical, and upon which the whole superstructure rests, and that is the character and condition of the individual members of the fraternity, for they are the blocks of stone of which the temple is builded, and as such are represented upon the altar. The newly admitted neophyte is the rough ashlar, squared but not yet trimmed or polished. The initiate who has completed the 3 degrees of the lesser mysteries is represented by the perfect ashlar, polished and lewist. This teaches you that in order to gain admission to even the first degree of these mysteries you must stand four square, firmly, upon a level basis. This basis of character is to be wrought upon by the diligent work of the mind. There will plays a part, but not the only part, or even the most considerable part. There is a skill technique in the mysteries by means of which the rough ashlar of character is polished into the perfect ashlar. In the stone this polishing is achieved firstly by the use of the chisel and mallet, knocking off the rough masses. This may be likened to life experience. Then follows the work of polishing the steady friction, which may be likened to the work of meditation. In the outer court you are taught first how to acquire knowledge by meditation. In the inner court you begin to learn how to acquire power by meditation, and the first power you acquire is power over yourself, without which no other powers can be handled. This is your fulcrum. You are not taught how to acquire power over yourself until you have gained the knowledge which teaches you how to use that power over yourself rightly, not doing violence to your known nature nor yet setting up a deformity or unbalance within it. You must understand life in all its aspects before you are competent to apply power to your own nature. First, then, realize that your being is divided into two parts, the higher self and the lower self. The higher self building around the nucleus of the divine spark evolving throughout evolution - the lower self building around the nucleus of the basic angle in the triangle of the higher self, the unit of incarnation. When, upon the path, you are striving after that state which shall enable you to give expression to your higher self in the personality, by means of a certain technique you can aid the process. Firstly, realize this, that while in incarnation your consciousness is focused in the personality by means of sensation and emotion. Consequently, if you desire to alter the focus of consciousness, you must acquire control of sensation and emotion, and learn at will to reduce them to a minimum. There is an irreducible minimum beyond which you cannot reduce them. In order to achieve such control, you work firstly upon the emotions. To achieve control of these, you imagine yourself to be your individuality. You raise consciousness to that level by meditating upon the evolution of the divine spark, which is the nucleus of your being. You realize it as issuing from the dark light of the unmanifest into manifestation, where it is a light in darkness. You conceive of your experiences as that spark through the earlier phases of evolution, circling with the rings and rays in limitless space. You imagine the formulation of form and the great tides moving in the cosmos. You picture to yourself the dim soul asleep in unconsciousness, overshadowing its shadowy vehicle. You picture the slow contacting of consciousness through the sensory organs of that vehicle, its crude sensations, its primeval desires, food, fighting and mating. And so you conceive of the rise of consciousness from the primordial slime, up through the bestiality of the primeval human into the slow dawn of culture, the rise of the ancient civilizations, the great pagan cults close to nature, that drain your soul with human sacrifice and orgy, the steady progression of humanity from culture to culture, the refining away of the brute, the manifesting of the human, the overshadowing of the angelic. So does man rise, coming from God, and returning to God as a God. And remember, it is the garnered essence of all these experiences that makes man as he is today, and you have missed none of them, and they are all latent in your deeper memories. On this basis you build, into these primordial and primeval depths as into a rich and fertile soil you strike your roots downwards, that you may raise the flower of life above them. No root, no flower, and your flower is in proportion to your root, as any gardener will tell you. Reach deeply and consciously down into the primordial, and draw thence the flower of life. Do not fear the primordial, though it is terrible, do not despise it or condemn it, though it is base. In elemental strength must you be rooted. From blood sacrifice and orgy the mysteries arose. Today we work them on a higher rock, but the principles do not change. Upon the principles of sacrifice and polarity the mysteries are worked, changing from the physical, to the astral, to the mental, and to the spiritual as the ages pass. By thus transferring the focus of consciousness by the work of the imagination, backward up the great river of time to its source, down the great river of time in its flowing, so do you learn to identify yourself with your higher self, realizing the richness of the background from which you arose. Then consider the personality of incarnation, viewed from this standpoint. See it in perspective, realize that evolution stretches before you just as it stretches behind you, and that the life of the personality is but a day between a sleep and a sleep. See it in perspective and in proportion. You have had many personalities, you shall have many more. Personalities are ephemeral. There is but one thing that matters concerning the personality that you should work out in that brief span between birth and death, your measure of evolutionary experience. And how shall you do this? By realizing what manner of personality has been given you to work within this life, and what you need to do with it during the opportunity thus afforded you for development and progress. Consider, then, your own personality in the light of your evolutionary past, and remember that in the space between conception and maturity you recapitulate that past biologically as the unborn, psychologically as the immature. Through all the phases of your past you go until the full stature of your development is achieved as a fully grown and mature-minded human being. In each life you should add something to your stature, and it is your task to discover what this may be, and how you shall fulfill your destiny, for each one comes into incarnation with a destiny to fulfill, and this destiny you read in your own heart by learning what it is towards which it impels you in your deepest self, when you are true to the life urge within you, not what custom directs, but what life requires of you. Dare to be your true self in your own mind, even if the circumstances of your life deny you the outward expression thereof, for action in the outer world is but a mirror in which we see reflected back to us that which is within. Be true to yourself within yourself, and life will reflect opportunity back to you. Deny your true self within yourself, and life will reflect back to you frustration. Only when you are your true self, only when you have come to terms with your real nature, can you stand upright upon your feet, in equilibrium, security and inner peace. Thus do you perform the process of self-examination in the light of cosmic time, and then, having examined and adjusted yourself to your true self, you take your personality in hand and make it your mask. Like the magical images in the temples of Atlantis, you make of your personality your instrument of expression.